Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we'll speak with healthcare wonk Harold Pollack from the University of Chicago about the explosion of Trump Care or Ryan Care. We've run a couple of what they call encore episodes in the past few weeks, and I didn't want to miss that. I mean, it was a rather momentous defeat for the right, even though it happened last week. Then with Neil Gorsuch's nomination in play, With the nomination of Neil Gorsuch in play, we'll be joined by Daniel Dudas from Public Citizens Chamber Watch. Gorsuch did not talk a lot about his judicial philosophy, so we're going to talk to Dudas about the legal theories embraced by corporate America, because in private practice, Gorsuch used to litigate on behalf of the Chamber of Commerce. First, a few items you may have missed. Despite controlling all of the levers of government, the GOP is having trouble legislating because they have this Freedom Caucus group that has no interest in governing, really. And that's what it comes down to. They'd rather say no than even appear to be open to any sort of compromise. Well, more on them later. In the meantime, they're rolling back Obama's executive actions with a vengeance. And let's recall that he had to use executive power quite a bit because congressional Republicans would have voted against, I don't know, a monument to Ronald Reagan if Barack Obama had proposed it. This week, Paul Ryan crowed on Twitter, and I quote, "Another regulatory power grab from the Obama administration is getting rolled back. This one reverses a harmful U.S. fish and wildlife rule." Sounds good and populist, right populist, doing the people's work, rolling back those crazy, burdensome regulations that make our lives hell, right? And what was this harmful wildlife rule? Well, I'm glad you asked. It was a rule barring inhumane hunting practices on public lands, including killing an animal while it hibernates. This was a burdensome, harmful rule keeping you from shooting a hibernating bear. Rolling back the rule will also allow goobers to bait animals and shoot them from a helicopter. So it's all fair, right? It's all fair. Bait animals, shoot them from a helicopter, whatever. Shoot them while they're sleeping in their dens. This passed on a party line vote, and honestly, I don't know what's wrong with these people. I wonder how many knew what was in the bill. It's possible that some of them just voted instinctively against an Obama-era regulation pertaining to the environment. Oh, it's an environmental reg from Obama. It must be bad. So let's let them shoot sleeping bears. This week, Trump also canceled Obama's executive orders on coal-fired power plants. He lifted a moratorium on leasing coal on public lands. This raises the very real possibility that a goofy American TV star elected by 26% of eligible voters in a planet, in a country where 5% of the population lives, could doom the entire planet. Ben Adler has a piece at the Washington Post, and maybe we'll have him on next week. We'll see. Arguing that planetary destruction may not be in Trump's power. At the end of the day, maybe he's not capable of destroying the planet. First, a lot of the emissions cuts that are underway are, practically speaking, irreversible, right? I mean, several big companies, for example, said this week that the pledges that they'd made to Barack Obama to reduce their own emissions in advance of the Paris Climate Summit would be honored regardless of what comes out of Washington. And investments have been made in renewables. They're not going to cancel those projects. It's a lot of this can't be reversed. And what's more important, it's a global problem, meaning that if the U.S. doesn't lead, someone else can take the lead. And we'll end up just losing some more influence. To that end, Reuters reports, and I quote, that Miguel Arias Cañete, the EU's climate action commissioner, said this week, "The continued leadership of the EU, China, and many other major economies is now more important than ever. When it comes to climate and the global clean energy transition, there cannot be vacuums. There can only be drivers, and we are committed to driving this agenda forward." So again, in the end, this stupidity may only serve to isolate us further than Trump is already isolating us. All right, let's return to the Freedom Caucus briefly. I hate that we grant them that label, given that their ideology is so antithetical to actual freedom. It's like freedom for the powerful to rule over the rest of us. But setting that aside, there are 30-something members of the House Freedom Caucus, but we're really talking about the fact that there are around 80 members of what Ryan Lizza called the Suicide Caucus. These are very conservative Republicans in districts that are also very, very right-wing. And the reality is that they're insulated from public opinion writ large. In their districts, they fear a Tea Party challenger beating them from the right in a primary more than they fear a Democratic opponent in a general election, right? So the Freedom Caucus may be the most ideological among that group. But it is, they are part of a larger group that doesn't have the same incentives as the rest of the caucus that has to run elections in competitive districts. Donald Trump tangled with the Freedom Caucus this week after his health care bill blew up. But they're going to be a pain in his ass throughout his time in the White House because we'll see this dynamic again and again. Anything that the Freedom Caucus might sign on to is going to be politically unpopular. That's guaranteed. Outside of the Fox News set, that is. And it's going to be hard to stomach for the rest of the party, for those who represent competitive districts, to sign on to whatever is cruel enough to attract Freedom Party members. So I could see an alternative universe where Donald Trump and his entourage had some handle on how to do their jobs. You know, Trump isn't really beholden to the hard right, and he might have tried to pick off a handful of red state Democrats to work with him and frozen out the Freedom Caucus. He could have actually gotten things done by pursuing that strategy. And I even imagine that would have been popular with his supporters, who see him not as a right-wing avatar, but as a businessman and deal maker who can get things done. But of course, Steve Bannon wouldn't have countenanced such an approach, and it appears that he's made zero efforts to reach out to the other side. He banked on the Republican majorities. He has these big majorities in Congress. He banked on these majorities making that work. But he didn't factor in this bunch of conservatives who don't even believe in government. They don't believe in it. And now it's too late. The relationship is way too toxic between Trump and congressional Democrats. It's just too toxic. And his poll numbers are way too low for anyone to fear opposing him. So Trump tweeted this week, and I quote, "The Freedom Caucus will hurt the entire Republican agenda if they don't get on the team and fast. We must fight them and Dems in 2018. So he's suggesting that maybe he'll primary Freedom Caucus members in 2018. But here's the thing. He can fight them or the Dems, but not both. That's simple math. If you take the Freedom Caucus and the Dems out of the picture, you're left with fewer than 218 members. And at the end of the day, this dynamic may be the thing that really minimizes the damage that Trump does. It's sad that we have to count on gridlock and political incompetence from the White House, but that's kind of where we are. Anyway, let's move along with the show. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with Harold Pollack. Stay tuned.
When you were here before, you couldn't look you in the eye. You're just like an angel. Your skin makes me cry. You flow like a feather in a beautiful world. I wish I was special. You're so very special, but I don't care if it hurts. I wanna have control. I want the perfect body. I want a perfect soul. And I want you to notice when I'm not around. You're so very special.
Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Harold Pollack, who is a professor of public health at the University of Chicago and also a Mensch. Professor Pollack, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for taking the time. I should note that when the rest of us were despondent about the fate of the ACA, you were quite optimistic. And I'll confess that I kind of thought you were underestimating the degree to which conservatives in the Republican Party would be willing to inflict damage on their constituents in order to fulfill their campaign promises. So kudos to you for getting that one right, at least so far.
Well, it's funny because the day of, I was more pessimistic. I had actually surveyed 67 elite health policy people, you know, people who had, you know, run Medicare and Medicaid, stuff like that. And, you know, and most of them thought in the week before that Republicans would somehow find a way to at least pass this thing through the House. But yeah, I was certainly, I do feel that, you know, the same path dependence that belabored Democrats belabored Republicans too. And it's awfully hard to, particularly with the shoddy product that they had, to really take a swing at a $3 trillion chunk of the American economy.
I understand healthcare is hard, complicated. And who knew? Who knew that?
Yeah, that's right. Who knew that?
Harold, you wrote at Politico that the bill failed because it was a dumpster fire. You wrote, and I quote, "So why did Republicans fail? In a word, insincerity." Insincerity. It's an interesting way to put it. Can you unpack that for us?
Yeah, but that was more acerbic than I usually am. I'm a fairly mild-mannered person, although I'm certainly explicitly liberal. You know, they had 7 years to come up with an alternative to the Affordable Care Act, and there was a lot of really hard work required. One of the hardest aspects of the task is to disappoint your own supporters about various things that you really, you know, can't get done, and then to say, okay, here's what we can get done, and let's craft legislative language that actually works. And they spent 7 years, you know, sending up to President Obama these extreme repeal bills that they knew that he would veto. You know, Tom Price being author of you know, some of those efforts, and at least in spirit, and those were clearly never going to be politically feasible as an actual policy. You know, you have to prepare people for what really has to be done. When I think about Democrats in 2006, 7, and 8, and what they did in the roll up to ACA, that's what Republicans needed to do. And so you get your stakeholders together. You know, on the Democratic side, there were some really tough conversations. You had to say to people, you know, a lot of us really admire single payer. That's not what we can do right now.
Yes.
And so here's a compromise position that we can all buy into. Here's some areas where we're willing to push, but at some point there's going to be a limit to how hard we can push. And, you know, one of the ironies about calling ACA Obamacare is that actually if John Edwards or Hillary Clinton had been elected in 2008, I think we would have seen a very similar bill because it reflected all that hard work. And Republicans just hadn't done it. And one of the consequences of that is that they were slapping things together literally 12 hours before they were hoping to vote. They were making monster changes to the bill that had profound implications that no one could even analyze in time.
Yeah.
And, it was just such a shambolic exercise. But the reason that it was so amateurish at the last minute was because they were not willing to really put in the work in the long lead up to it to do something realistic. And I think that really speaks very poorly of the, you know, sort of the low quality of craftsmanship and what they were doing.
When you look on the Democratic side with the ACA and think about what you describe in that Politico piece, which is getting together stakeholders and really kind of setting the stage for a major legislative push. Then they held endless hearings, 9 months, I think the process was, perhaps even longer than that. It's pretty remarkable that they have the talking point that Democrats kind of did it behind closed doors and jammed it down the public's throat without knowing what was in the bill. Anyway.
Well, there was 150 Republican amendments in the Senate bill for ACA. By the way, you could argue, I think it was actually a mistake for the Democrats to draw out the process as long as we did. And now, of course, it's true that, you know, if you're a conservative, you don't like ACA. Republicans had many opportunities to influence that bill, and as I'm sure we'll get into, there's a lot about ACA that is congenial to a market perspective, and
yes,
Republicans have done absolutely nothing to preserve those aspects of the law that would strengthen the private insurance system.
Yes, we are going to talk about that. I think it's important to note that the bill was awful, but not painful enough for the so-called Freedom Caucus. And the issue for Republicans was that they couldn't make it cruel enough for the hard right without losing people more to the center right. On Thursday, The Hill reported that Republicans may take another bite at the apple in the next week or two. I have to say I didn't find that story very credible. It noted that kind of lawmakers are just talking. There's nothing on the schedule. But let me ask you this. Do you think that they have a chance that they could bridge those differences and come up with a bill that would then get through the Senate?
I don't think so. And I think this was such a public humiliation that, I was waiting for someone to just say it's only a flesh wound, you know, while they went back to go at it again.
I made that joke on Twitter.
Did you really?
Yes, I did.
Oh, I'm sorry that I didn't notice that.
It's the okay.
It's so, but I do think there's other things they can do in the Trump administration. You know, you got the president of the United States with all the powers there, but I think that you know, once you have shown so demonstrably that you've failed and the things that you would have to do something that is successful would be so painful. I think their actual strategy that failed was just get something over into the Senate, and then whatever the Senate does, you somehow bully over the finish line.
Right.
And I think that's part of why they didn't even care about all the sort of amateurish aspects of what was in the House bill, because I think there was a sense that it just wasn't going to matter. But I think once you've done that and failed, it's awfully hard. Now, one question is, suppose that the exchanges really tank and then Republicans come back and say, OK, we got to do something here. I think that, you know, that could well, their fallback strategy could well be let's wait for bad news, blame it on President Obama and then try to come back there. I'm pretty optimistic that the Democrats can beat that back. What I'm not optimistic about is that we can actually deal with the real problems in health policy and actually fix some of the problems that we're seeing, particularly in the marketplaces around the country. And a lot of people we saved ACA and helped a lot of people from a disaster, but there's millions of people around America who are going to be offered very poor health insurance that they can't really afford. And we really do have to do something about this. And this, you know, winning a defensive battle was important, but it still doesn't solve a lot of the issues that have to be addressed.
Yeah, that's true. I should also note that on Friday, Axios reported that a peacemaking effort between these two groups, the Freedom Caucus and the Tuesday group, which are these more moderate Republicans, descended into hostility and mutual recriminations. The bottom line for me seems to be that the right is having such a hard time with healthcare, not only because it's complicated, but also because their ideological priors kind of run into a brick wall of reality when you get into the details. So,
yep.
Like, you can say competition and patient-oriented care, and those are nice slogans, but at the end of the day, they're not going to cover people who aren't insured by their employers and can't afford the crazy costs in the individual marketplace. If you're just tuning in, this is Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. I'm talking healthcare with Harold Pollack, the mild-mannered Harold Pollack.
So I would say your last insight, by the way, I think many of the most politically self-immolating aspects of that Republican bill really came straight out of, you know, the fundamental presumptions of what they were trying to do. You know, you say we want to have more modest financial help for people who have trouble affording health insurance. We want to have age-based rather than income-based subsidies for people. We want to have a weaker individual mandate. We want to allow insurers to cover a less comprehensive package of things. You add all that together, and that's how you end up with a 64-year-old with a $26,500 income seeing their premiums go up by 760%.
Right.
I mean, it astonishes me that you could write a document, that any politician would write a document that contains a $12,900 increase on low-income near retirees. That is, especially when this is your political base.
And that's why the Tuesday group wouldn't buy in. Let's not pretend that they could not pass something, that Republicans were not eager to repeal Obamacare, right? I mean, the bottom line is that the disastrous CBO projections played a huge role in the outcome here.
And why didn't they have their own? Why didn't they have? Did they actually know that these projections were coming? I mean, don't they have their own? You know, I have a computer on my desk.
Don't they have their own models? I would go back to your point. They were not trying to come up with a serious healthcare reform bill, right?
They're trying to get something passed. Yes.
Yeah.
So anyway, I digress.
No, so I want to return to something that we were just talking about. Trump is saying he'll let Obamacare implode and then try to cut a deal with Democrats. And I would point out that Trump might have been able to do something with Democrats at the beginning, but I think trying to do healthcare without them and then attacking them when his own side couldn't pass it was kind of made that relationship, that potential relationship, so toxic. That ship has sailed. But the death spiral is not happening. According to the CBO, the ACA's markets are more or less stable to degrees that vary by state. But more or less stable, there is no death spiral going on right now. But I want to ask you, what exactly can Donald Trump do in terms of executive action that might make that death spiral lie that we see on Fox News a reality? And are there countervailing forces that might, like, keep him in check?
That's a very good question. I think that I must say, by the way, that it is so striking to me that there is bipartisan support to defend Medicaid, straightforward expansion of government insurance, and there is very little bipartisan support to do the things that need to be done to protect, you know, a market-based system that tries to, you know, preserve private insurance coverage. I mean, that's just, to me, such an interesting development that there's no politician in America who politically owns those marketplaces except for one person who is not president anymore.
Right.
And, you know, no one is going to expend any political capital on the Republican side to make sure that death spiral doesn't happen. And whereas in Medicaid, they really will. You know, you got more than 30 governors who are saying basically, we care a lot about our state Medicaid program, and you know, and don't damage it. I think that there's a lot that Trump can do to damage the exchanges if he thinks that that's in his interests. First of all, he can just use the bully pulpit to just denigrate them. And, you know, if I'm an insurer, why would I want to get involved in something when my major customer is always, you know, bad mouthing the product, and when there's a million administrative decisions that they have to make to sort of provide care and feeding to this complicated and delicate apparatus? They can also, there's a big question about payments to insurers that, you know, there were some lawsuits under the Obama administration that Republicans were pushing to try to cut off payments to insurers that allow them to do to protect consumers from out-of-pocket payments. And, you know, this sort of so-called CSR set of issues, and the administration can back off of those. They can fail to enforce the individual mandate, which would weaken the insurance pool.
Now, they've already told the IRS not to enforce or to go easy on enforcing the mandate, right?
Yeah, and that's very popular to do. And so there's a lot they can do. Now, one question is whether the insurance industry and whether cooler heads in Congress and the Republican Party will act as some source for restraint. I'm convinced that I think, you know, one theory is they'll force the Democrats to the table by blowing up the exchanges. The other theory is they will enrage Democrats and they will enrage consumers, be blamed for what happened. You know, if you're out there publicly saying we're going to blow up the exchanges and then the exchanges blow up, it's kind of hard for you to say it's the Democrats' fault. And I think the Democrats may well say, you know, we're just going to wait until 2020. You're a very unpopular president. We've got a very good chance of unseating you. And we got our own plans for replacing, you know, those marketplaces. And we're just going to wait on that. And, you know, I don't see why the Democrats would be super eager to capitulate to an extremely unpopular president who probably doesn't even have a viable plan. If these things do go into a death spiral, I just don't know what it is that Trump could demand of the Democrats where the Democrats would say, hey, this is actually going to rescue the situation and at least return us a hostage alive. You know, I think there's a real danger that he could actually destroy these exchanges, but destroy them in a way where he has no path back to accomplish anything, you know, to trade anything away to Democrats. It's not so clear to me that if he really vandalizes these exchanges, that there's a ready fix for them, you know, that he's ready to put on the negotiating table.
Now, what I was trying to kind of get at is that there are, if you look at the lobbying that the hospitals did, that the AARP did, you know, it's not like there aren't outside pressures on Republicans to not screw this pooch. They exist. Now, you mentioned Medicaid, and it's interesting to me that almost all of our debate centered around the exchanges. And, you know, there was a lot of talk about premiums increasing and all the problems. There are real problems in the exchanges. There was a lot of talk about those. But the Medicaid expansion covered 11 million people, would have covered another 2.6 million if red states hadn't refused to participate. Yep. And there were a number of those center-right Republicans, the Tuesday Group Republicans, who killing the Medicaid expansion was really the issue, or was a major part of their opposition to the AHCA. Did Medicaid kind of save the ACA?
I think there's a good argument that it did. And every, you know, you have 15 or 16 Republican governors who really did not want ACA to be the Medicaid aspect of ACA to be repealed. And it's so striking to me when you four Republican governors sent a letter to Congress that was very, very critical of the AHCA. And what was amazing to me was there was such a tactile sense of what they were talking about that was completely the opposite of the way House Republicans approached this issue. I mean, this was written by people who knew they were going to have to live with whatever was decided in the House. You know, they said, if you're really going to block grant, here's how we want you to do it. And we want you to go to CBO and get real numbers for this. And we want you to think about these different populations. And, you know, it had that kind of sense of reality and policy craftsmanship that, that the AHCA totally lacked. And I think a lot of the people, a lot of the moderate Republicans in Congress were watching this, and they were just saying, you know, we just cannot damage all of our colleagues, you know, at the state and local level. You know, if they had done that to Medicaid, I think all over the country, there would have been a very well-defined political home address that said, you have just deep, every hospital, every person who lost their Medicaid, you know, every provider that, that you've now really hurt, they're going to know exactly who did that. It's not going to be like the marketplaces where you can sort of say, oh, it's too bad, it kind of, you know, imploded or whatever. This is, no, this is, you went on and did this. And rightly so, a lot of moderate Republicans were saying, we just can't do this. Plus, by the way, the other thing is a lot of Republicans are actually proud of what they've accomplished with the Medicaid expansion. You know, you go to, I talk to people around the country, Republican officials, in research that I do on substance use policy, and they are doing a lot of stuff, and they're actually quite proud of it. They've spent years on it. They spent billions of dollars, and they honestly want to continue doing what they're doing, and they're really annoyed that you know, that this is all put at risk by people who really don't even know really what they're talking about as far as how to fix these systems.
Right. Harold Pollack, I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today. We are in a really messy situation, and I appreciate your clear-headed analysis of what's been going on.
Thank you so much. I'm feeling good. I think this is a very generative moment, and I've greatly increased my odds that we're going to get some sort of a public option at the end of the day, and that Republicans have helped the Democrats get done what was a bridge too far in ACA. So history has many ironies in this.
From your lips to the flying spaghetti monster's ears. Folks, we're going to take a quick break and then be right back. Stay tuned.
Two colts were before me, an old and a new. I asked my sweet master, what must I do? The yoke was ugly, so tattered and torn. The other, a new one, had never been worn. I'll tell you the best thing I ever did do. I took off the yoke
Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm still Joshua Holland. You know, it's unfortunate that on the left, the broad left, the issue of Russian meddling in the 2016 election has become so entangled with these like lingering grievances from the Democratic primaries. And you see this all the time, and it's often fairly explicit. Those who dismiss the intelligence agency's findings on Russian interference often say quite clearly that the problem they have with the story is that it absolves Hillary Clinton from any responsibility for her loss to Trump. So Russian meddling, in this view, is being hyped by Clinton partisans hell-bent on avoiding blame. Frankly, that's a position I don't even understand, because there's no conflict between saying Hillary Clinton was an unpopular candidate, or that her campaign made some really key strategic errors, and acknowledging that the Russians played an active role in her defeat. Both of those things can be true at the same time, right? Remember that she was the second most unpopular candidate in history, and she lost to the most unpopular candidate in history, and she won 3 million more votes. Also, if you were a Clinton partisan seeking to shift blame away, frankly, you'd be on a lot more solid ground blaming FBI Director James Comey's substance-free but totally scandalous letter to Congress 11 days before the election. There's quite a bit of evidence that that shifted the race in a way that we can't say is true definitively of the Russian campaign. But I just wanted to take a moment and share a bit of testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee this week. It's by Clint Watts, a former FBI agent and an expert in counterterrorism. Here, he's not talking about hacking. He's talking about the so-called dark PR campaign and the fact that we're just vulnerable to disinformation because we no longer agree on objective facts. So that means that we're all kind of susceptible to fake news. Let's listen in for a moment. His interlocutor, by the way, is Senator James Lankford, a Republican from Oklahoma.
Part of the reason active measures have worked in this U.S. election is because the commander-in-chief has used Russian active measures at time against his opponents. On 14 August 2016, his campaign chairman, after a debunked Interlake...
When you say his, who's his?
Paul Manafort, okay. Cited the fake Interlake story as a terrorist attack on CNN, and he used it as a talking point. On 11 October, President Trump stood on a stage and cited what appears to be a fake news story from Sputnik News that disappeared from the internet. He denies the intel from the United States about Russia. He claimed that the election could be rigged. That was the number one theme pushed by RT, Sputnik News, white outlets all the way up until the election. He's made claims of voter fraud, that President Obama is not a citizen, that, you know, Congressman Cruz is not a citizen. So part of the reason active measures works, and it does today in terms of Trump Tower being wiretapped, is because they parrot the same lines. So Putin is correct. He can say that he's not influencing anything because he's just putting out his stance. But until we get a firm basis on fact and fiction in our own country, get some agreement about the facts, whether it be do I support the intelligence community or a story I read on my Twitter feed, we're going to have a big problem. I can tell you right now today, gray outlets that are Soviet pushing accounts tweet at President Trump during high volumes when they know he's online, and they push conspiracy theories. So if he is to click on one of those or cite one of those, it just proves Putin correct, that we can use this as a lever against the Americans.
So this started in 2008-09 time period, as you've cited before with your previous timeline. Even before this rose up, even when there were 16 Republican candidates on the stage, this was a long time coming, and it seemed to be very well organized this time. Part of my question is, I get that completely. Why this time? They look to be more prepared, probing, evaluating states, trying to get into voter records, trying to be more active in the process.
They have plausible deniability. If you wanted to run this during the Cold War, you would have had to put agents inside the United States. They would have been stalked by counterintelligence professionals. They would have been run down. You couldn't have gained an audience on a communist newspaper, for example. Today, you can create the content, gain the audience, build the bots, pick out the election and even the voters that are valued the most in swing states, and actually insert the right content in a deliberate period. They pre-planned it. They were based a year and a half out. They're doing it today on the European elections. And here's the other thing that needs to come up. They try all messages. You know, we've been very focused on, you know, our presidential election. The Republicans, you know, tend to come up. But the Democrats, they were there too. They were with Bernie Sanders supporters trying to influence them in different directions. So they play all sides. They, much like I learned in infantry school about how they use artillery, they fire artillery everywhere. And once they get a break in the wall, that's where they swarm in and they focus. And they do that very well today. You'll see them in Europe supporting people on the left or right, whichever will dismantle the democratic function that they're after. So I think the important point moving forward is we have to educate our public and even our institutions. And the mainstream media is right to be taking some on the chin right now. They've fallen for a lot of these fake news stories. They've amplified it, and they've not gone back and done good fact-checking. The media needs to improve. Our U.S. government institutions need to improve. And we got to help Americans understand what the facts are. Because if we don't, we are lost. We will become two separate, maybe three separate worlds in the United States just because of this little bitty pinprick that was put in by a foreign country.
There you have it. And I just note that the Senate appears to be conducting a relatively serious investigation, unlike the utter clown show going on in the House. Stay tuned. We're going to break again, and then we'll be right back with Daniel Dudas. Welcome back to the show. I have a piece up at The Nation this week arguing that Democrats have nothing to lose by blocking the nomination of Neil Gorsuch, Donald Trump's pick for a seat that Republicans effectively stole from Obama. And the point that I made is pretty straightforward. First, approving Gorsuch without a fight means defying the base. At a time when Democrats really need an energized progressive movement to have any chance of taking the House in 2018. And you need to understand that because of gerrymandering and other factors, they need to win the popular vote by about 8 points to have a chance. And more importantly, the reason they're hesitating is out of fear of Mitch McConnell invoking the so-called nuclear option and getting rid of the filibuster for SCOTUS appointments. And that assumes that the filibuster is a good thing. It's not. It's actually an accident of early 19th century history, and it's undemocratic. And also, you know, because of shifting demographics, killing the filibuster will probably hurt Republicans more than it does Democrats over the long haul, even though Democrats certainly need to rely on that tool now in an age of consolidated Republican control of government. Anyway, check that piece out at The Nation. One thing I didn't discuss is Gorsuch's jurisprudence. For me, it doesn't matter that much because, again, it was a seat that was stolen by a president with questionable legitimacy. And also because Gorsuch was careful to avoid saying anything about his judicial philosophy during those hearings. But I wanted to highlight one aspect of Gorsuch's past in light of a new report that my next guest authored. Reuters reports, and I quote, "Gorsuch, a conservative federal appeals court judge from Colorado, nominated by wealthy businessman Trump, could turn out to be a friend to business, having represented the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in fending off securities class actions, one of the most hotly contested areas of corporate law. They go on to say that if he's confirmed, Gorsuch would be the only current justice who has a long background working for businesses in private practice. So what does that suggest? Well, to help figure that out, I'm joined now by Daniel Dudas. Daniel is the head of Chamber Watch, which is a project of Public Citizen. Daniel, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Good to be with you, Joshua. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for taking the time. Daniel and his colleague Lisa Gilbert have a report on the Chamber of Commerce's litigation against workers, consumers, the environment. Daniel, where can listeners find that report if they want to read the whole thing?
They want to read the whole thing, they can go on www.publiccitizen.org or www.chamberofcommercewatch.org.
And you write that the goal was to understand the factual and legal arguments that are common to the chamber's litigation. Let's run through some of those things. First, there's the matter of closing the courthouse doors to kind of ordinary people, to people who are harmed by big businesses. What does that mean?
Yeah, that's a really important part of what they do. And in fact, when we looked at about 500 cases that they'd been active in over the last roughly 3 years, we found that that was the number one legal issue they litigated. So what that means is they go to bat for large corporations in arguing before the courts, both federal and state, sometimes the Supreme Court, sometimes lower courts, that essentially what are known as forced arbitration clauses or class action bans should be enforced. So that means, say, you have a dispute with your credit card company, your cable company over some fees that you find on your bill that, in fact, you don't think you really owe, and they're telling you you do owe. They're going to say if you try to take them to court, no, you can't have an impartial judge hear this case. They're going to say, no, we're going to go to arbitration, which means they get to pick someone who has received some training in dispute resolution, but is certainly not a judge, is picked by them, and in fact depends upon his or her future business by essentially issuing rulings that corporations are going to like, which means corporations are going to hire them again in the future to hear these cases. So it's a really rigged system that corporations have set up, and it really discourages people from actually trying to resolve issues where they've been harmed by corporations, and it guarantees that in cases where people do actually try to resolve these issues, that the outcome is going to be favorable to the corporation.
And, you know, I hear conservatives, often they talk about small businesses. I've long said that that's kind of a scam, in effect, that they talk about small businesses, but at the end of the day, they are beholden to big businesses, and those interests are not always aligned. There are clear tensions between the interests of small businesses and mega corporations, right? Tell us about that aspect of the chamber's work.
Absolutely. I mean, that's something that comes through in a lot of the cases in which the chamber's been involved. So sort of the main, most recent Supreme Court case dealing with access to the courts is called Italian Colors. And Italian Colors is actually the name of a small independent restaurant, Italian restaurant, of course. I believe it's in Oakland, California, somewhere in the Bay Area. And they became involved in a legal dispute with giant multinational American Express. So the Chamber of Commerce supports American Express in this case against this small restaurant. Another iconic example of that is, I'm sure your listeners will remember the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf. You had all of these millions and millions of barrels of oil that were spilled into the Gulf. You had fishermen, you had hotel and motel owners, you had, you know, all sort of the tourist industry along the Gulf Coast there was really, really impacted. People just obviously didn't want a vacation on the Gulf Coast that summer. A lot of these were small businesses. So these small businesses get together in a class action suit to sue BP for the economic damage that they've sustained. Well, who does the Chamber of Commerce, whose side do they take in this litigation? They take the giant British multinational side over all of these thousands of American small businesses by saying that, you know, the class action suit is inappropriate and that they shouldn't be allowed to all sue together in the way that had already been agreed to, in fact, by BP in that case at a prior stage of the litigation. So you see time and again the messaging that the chamber and the Republican Party and other groups use to sort of wrap themselves in the cloak of small business, you know, what's more American than mom apple pie and small business? It's really just messaging. It's really just window dressing because, in fact, more often than not, small businesses are much more similar to consumers and are going to become involved in the same sorts of legal disputes and be victims of the same sorts of corporate wrongdoing as are consumers.
You know, Lawrence Mitchell at George Washington University wrote a book a few years ago called The Speculation Economy. And he talked about how in big corporations, there is a tendency to focus almost myopically on short-term profits and in a way that often leads to poorer performance over the longer term, over the longer horizon. He cited a survey in that book that found that 80% of CEOs running major American corporations would have, and I quote, at least moderately mutilated their businesses in order to meet financial analysts' quarterly profit estimates. I guess that philosophy extends to the Chamber of Commerce's lawyers as well. Can you tell us a little bit about this robber baron view of businesses that the chamber takes?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of ways, I think, in which this this is manifested through the litigation they do. And I should say for your listeners, you know, the chamber is far more than just litigation. They are by far the largest lobbying group in the U.S. They've spent more than $1.3 billion lobbying in the last 20 years. They're one of the largest dark money election spenders, having spent over $150 million. And that's just in congressional elections over the last roughly 10 years. So, you know, they do a lot more than litigation, but this report was focusing on their litigation. So that being said, you know, yeah, there are a lot of ways. One case I think is really emblematic of this is, you know, they don't seem to realize what a lot of management experts are now realizing, and even some, you know, not particularly known for their, you know, sort of touchy-feeliness corporate social responsibility type companies like Walmart are realizing that if you pay your employees nothing and treat them like crap, you are not going to have good productivity and you're going to have high turnover, you're going to have dirty stores, you're going to have poor customer service. And so a lot of companies are realizing, you know what, actually, this is not a zero-sum game, that while, you know, maybe in the short term we might have to take some hit by paying workers more, we're going to have a higher quality workforce, it's going to be better trained, it's going to offer better service to our customers, and we're going to attract more business that way. But the chamber just doesn't get that. So, for example, they went to court to try to overturn a Seattle ordinance that would have required a $15 minimum wage. They supported, in this particular case, the fast food industry, which, of course, doesn't want to pay people a decent wage, a living wage. That's one example. Another example, again, I don't know what they have against the city of Seattle, but the city of Seattle had an ordinance that would have allowed the sort of ride-sharing industry, so Uber, Lyft, the drivers in that industry to unionize. Currently, they're seen as quote-unquote independent contractors. This Seattle ordinance would have allowed them to be seen as employees and therefore to unionize. Again, it's a sort of thing that if you have a union, you can negotiate for better benefits, for better working conditions, and actually create a system where you'll have people who are going to be more satisfied and provide better service to customers. There'll be less turnover. Again, the chamber was absolutely against that. Third example, you have a case where a big pharma company basically changed one little thing in an Alzheimer's drug that they were marketing. So they basically made the pill. It's the same active ingredient, does the same thing. They'd made it from a two-a-day pill to a one-a-day pill, and then they tried to repatent it and then take all of the two-a-day pill off the market. So people who were on the two-a-day pill couldn't be transitioned to the new generic that was going to come to the two-a-day pill. They'd already be on the one-a-day pill. And then because of stupid state laws, it becomes difficult to transfer people back. Anyway, long story short, they essentially tried to allow this pharma company to extend a patent by 14 years through these, you know, sort of completely ridiculous machinations. You know, not thinking of the impact on all of the other businesses that have to pay for health insurance for their employees who are going to get gouged this way. Of course, not thinking about the impact on employees, on people. So time and again, you just sort of see them involved in this litigation that really is just looking at, you know, how can we increase a company's profits, you know, just the next 6 months or the next quarterly report, because obviously those are the numbers that the executives are trying to hit because that's what their compensation depends upon.
Right. The link between compensation and short-term quarterly earnings. What they have against the city of Seattle is that it has a very progressive government. We've had a number of their city councilors on the show. And what they do is that they disprove a lot of these conservative myths. So they passed a $15 minimum wage law. Restaurant employment did not decline. You know, so that makes them crazy because it provides a living example of how reality runs headlong against their ideological priors. Finally, you talk about the chamber's relentless work to undo environmental regulations, public health, safety regulations, all of that. The key point here, I think, as you note in the report, the chamber, and I quote, ignores negative externalities and rejects the well-established economic doctrine that government regulation is necessary to correct them. What does that mean?
I think that this is something that you see again over and over in their litigation. They just don't accept the notion that whether we're talking about carbon dioxide emissions or pollutants into our rivers and streams, that there's a cost to this. And so, yeah, some company, it's cheaper for them. They're making more money because they don't have to worry about their carbon emissions or all the sludge they're dumping into some river. So there's one company, sure, and usually, you know, it's the one company, of course, the rich investors behind it are getting rich, but everyone else is paying an economic price to that. There is a cost, obviously, to global warming, whether it is, you know, if you want to not even think about the impact on people's lives, but just think about the impact on people's property, rising sea levels. You know, you have places like Miami Beach and, you know, other beach resorts that are, you know, having to invest millions and millions of dollars right now to build seawalls and build pumping stations. And obviously, it's only going to get worse. So they refuse to accept that, you know, that what some companies do has an economic impact on all of us. And that's something that unfortunately you see time and again. And I just think it's interesting that, you know, you and I were obviously progressives, but this is, you know, basic economics. This is not some progressive doctrine. This is basic economics that you open any intro macro economics textbook, even at the University of Chicago or any other of the more conservative schools. And this is what you're going to learn.
And I would just note one irony here. Conservative legal scholars have long argued that private enforcement, that is to say lawsuits, is superior to one-size-fits-all regulation. So their position is we don't need to regulate, say, polluters, because those harmed by pollution can always take them to court. They can get relief in the courts. So the chamber, at the same time, the chamber embraces that view, but also tries to make it harder for people to take them to court. So it's a real situation of damned if you do, damned if you don't. And I guess welcome to the new gilded age. Daniel Dudas, I believe we're about out of time. I really want to thank you for sharing your work with our listeners.
Well, thank you very much for having me on the show. It was a pleasure.
Folks, you can check out the report at Public Citizen. Is it citizen.org?
Citizen.org or chamberofcommercewatch.org.
One of those two sites, check it out. I'd also like to thank Harold Pollack for joining us today. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show at Podbean or iTunes or SoundCloud or wherever else you can find it. And you can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. I would like to thank the Smirking Chimp, Hullabaloo, and Crooks and Liars for letting me host the show at their respective joints. Of course, I would like to thank you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.